Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ted Van Dyke was a Washington insider and advisor to Democratic Party leaders for more than 40 years. From JFK and Hubert Humphrey's day to the Clinton years, he watched, advised, and studied a party now torn between two remarkable candidates, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. He's seen the good, the bad, and the ugly, or the heroes, hacks, and fools, as he puts it in his new book, of a party now once again looking for its way forward. This hour, On Point, the long view on the Democratic Party's moment with political insider Ted Van Dyke. You can join the conversation. How do you see the Democrats today, poised for resurgence or ready to tear themselves apart? And what can they learn from their party's own history, from the long view? Joining me today from Seattle is Ted Van Dyke. He was senior political advisor for decades to Democrats Hubert Humphrey, George McGovern, Jimmy Carter, Ted Kennedy, Walter Mondale, Gary Hart, and Paul Tsongas. The newspaper The Hill calls him the Forrest Gump of Democratic politics, meaning he sounds like he's seen it all. His new book is Heroes, Hacks, and Fools, Memoirs from the Political Inside. Ted Van Dyke, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Tom. I'm very glad to be with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Ted.
Hi, Jack.
Ted Van Dyke, that's a lot of history. And before that, even as I recall in your book, a little brief romp with Harry Truman in Manhattan and a St. Patrick's Day green carnation from JFK in the Oval Office.
Yes, I led one of those Herb and Woke lives. I kind of stumbled into everything.
You must be 1,050 years old.
I feel that way sometimes.
Just kidding. Ted, there's so much history we want to get into here because, I mean, if there was ever a time when on the Democratic Party side of the ledger a little perspective is in order, this must be it. How do you look out on this race today and with all of that history behind you, the Democratic kind of question that's sitting in front of the party now as they look at these candidates?
Well, I think we are really at a turning point, at least a possible turning point right now. And I take great encouragement from Barack Obama's candidacy. We have, maybe we're as we were in 1960, where you remember John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson were the two principal contenders at the convention.
Right.
Johnson, kind of the insider, the establishment guy who'd been there for a long time. John Kennedy, the attractive young pretender. I see Obama in exactly those terms. He's really energized the party and the country, and it really is inspiring to me. I see him as a throwback to those early 60 days, and I think we really have a chance to reach over some of the divisions in the country and the party, and I'm quite hopeful about him.
Now, to get all the cards on the table, I mean, you did work with Paul Tsongas when he was running for president.
I did.
Of course, that's when Bill Clinton was making his run in 92. You also,
yes,
in 96, came out even as a lifelong Democrat with an endorsement for Bob Dole. Those suggest that you haven't exactly been in the Clinton camp.
No, I don't dislike Bill or Hillary Clinton, but I thought in 1996 that Bob Dole was the better choice. I thought the party had become too cynical. I thought Bill Clinton had risked in his second term scandals, which indeed materialized. So I endorsed Dole as a one-time thing. I presume it's the only Republican vote I'll ever cast. But I'm not a anti-Hillary, but I'm pro-Obama. And I think he really does offer us an opportunity to reach across racial, gender, class, partisan other lines as we badly need to do right now.
Let's touch the kind of root stock, maybe, of your involvement as a political advisor. Hubert Humphrey was your man in a huge, huge way in the 1960s with a particular approach to American politics and Democratic Party politics. Just to begin to get the flavor of that man, we'll hear from others in this hour. Let's go all the way back to 1948. Humphrey made a historic speech in Philadelphia at the DNC, the Democrats' convention there. And here he is urging, this is already in 1948, a strong civil rights agenda be included in the Democratic platform. Listen closely. There's a lot of crackling in this archival tape.
I feel I must rise at this time to support a report, the minority report, a report that spells out our democracy. A report that the people of this country can and will understand, and a report that they will enthusiastically acclaim on the great issue of civil rights.
Hubert Humphrey in 1948, by the time it came to the 1968 Democratic Convention, we had real drama. We may have drama again this summer, but help us to begin to understand your political bearings, Ted Van Dyke. What was it way back when that drew you so powerfully to this man, Hubert Humphrey?
Well, in 1948, that was an act of great courage. I heard that speech on the radio. I was 14 years old and was moved by it. Of course, that was a pre-television age. As you may recall, President Harry Truman sponsored a majority plank, which was acceptable to the old Southern Committee chairs, very cautious. And Humphrey, by the force of his oratory on the floor of the convention in Philadelphia, changed the party's position on civil rights once and forever. And it was very inspiring. He was one of many in that period who really stood up against public opinion, prejudice, all obstacles on behalf of a very progressive agenda. And to explain myself, that's always been my approach. The politics in which I came up and which prevailed until about 20 years ago was one in which the entry point questions were, what are the country's needs? How do we propose to meet them? And how can we mobilize a majority on behalf of our proposals? Now, in more recent years, we've gotten caught up in campaign consultants and polling data, everything but an agenda. But those were the things that drove me forward in that time and, frankly, drove forward a whole generation of people in the Democratic Party.
Jack Beatty, Ted Van Dyke describes himself very much as a Depression-era kid with Democratic Party values and agenda orientation very much forged in the experience of his parents and his own youth in the shadow or guiding light of FDR that then came into some, as he sees it, headwinds in the time of Jimmy Carter, in the time of Bill Clinton, a kind of different view of what the Democratic Party might be or what it might do for different politicians.
Yes, and I think part of that, Ted, I think you would agree, is what happened on the race issue. I mean, running in 1968, Hubert Humphrey got 35% of the white vote, 97% of the black vote. And, you know, the white backlash to civil rights, both in the South and in the North, really, I think, helped to structure, to fracture that New Deal coalition that Ted talks about. And that in some ways, this Obama campaign, I think, is still running into some of it, at least. But would you agree, Ted, that issue more than anything else
yes,
helped to end?
Yes, you're absolutely correct, Jack. The post-election data in 1968 disclosed, for instance, that Humphrey lost not because of dissent by war protesters. Most of those votes came home to Humphrey at the end. But we lost instead to what later would be called Reagan Democrats, white blue-collar voters in Ohio, New Jersey, northern industrial states, who frankly thought he and others had gone too far, that the Great Society had gone too far. And it was a no vote on that progressive agenda, driven, in fact, by the 64 Civil Rights Act, the 65 Voting Rights Act, a whole panoply of progressive legislative proposals. So I think you've got it just right.
We want to come back and look at what happened at the 1968 convention and think about the Democrats' convention coming up this summer. But I wanted to ask you, Ted, I mean, you worked so much with Hubert Humphrey. You were such an admirer. You were so close to him. And yet you wrote this. And in the years to follow, I would witness many instances in which Humphrey's good-heartedness, or putting it another way, lack of the juggler instinct, would cost him dearly political, though it was also his enduring strength. When you look at Barack Obama in the contest with Hillary Clinton today, with that perspective, do you see that same lack of instinct to go for the juggler?
I think we're going to find out. He's going to be tested. We're going to have a very spirited competition from now until the Denver convention. We know that Hillary has a jugular instinct. Whether Obama does or not, we will soon discover, but he will need it.
Does a Democratic Party leader have to have it in order to push the agenda that you've cared about all your life? Humphrey, you say, didn't have so much of it,
Well, he had it on issues. For instance, he would risk his career on a progressive civil rights plank. But as an operational politician, it was not in him to be ruthless.
Not ruthless. And yet, when we came to 1968 and the Democratic Party convention in Chicago, there was ruthlessness enough to go around. The whole thing exploded right around him.
That's right. But he was essentially a spectator and a victim of that. He was not he was controlled by events, which if you read the book, you will find I had hoped he would not be. I would have had a strong peace position prior to the convention to preempt everything, so we would not have had that violence and division. But as things turned out, he was a victim.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're taking the long view today on the Democratic Party's moment with 40-year Democratic Party political advisor Ted Van Dyke. His new book is Heroes, Hacks, and Fools, Memoirs from the Political Inside. Jack Beatty is with us as well. Ted Van Dyke, I wish you'd take us back to 1968. A lot of Democrats are looking on out to Denver and the convention this summer, wondering if there'll be a Donnybrook on the convention floor. Take us back to 68, the sort of be-all and end-all of wild conventions. And you just got some remarkable history and sort of insider perspective in this book of what went on at that and around that convention.
Well, it was I wish 1968 could somehow have been erased from the calendar. You know, we had not only a highly divisive war going on, but you remember Martin Luther King had been killed and mm-hmm. Robert Kennedy. There was high emotion on all sides. There was a counterwave in the country, as Jack just pointed out, people opposing civil rights, progressive social agenda. The turmoil was far deeper and intense than what we're seeing this year. So I do not expect anything approximating that intensity in Denver this summer. Nonetheless, we do have the possibility of some divisiveness, particularly if neither Obama nor Hillary has enough votes for first ballot nomination. Then anything could happen, and we could go into overtime, have a brokered convention. And it will be very important for Democrats to have an outcome which is seen as fair, democratically derived, not fixed. So we have a potential for difficulty, but I don't think we'll face anything near the divisiveness that we had in 1968.
Jack, just for some perspective here, let's listen back for a moment. 1968, Vietnam War raging, the country deeply divided, Chicago, where their famously, where their convention was absolutely, more than pins and needles, I mean, just crackling. Here at that Democratic convention is Senator Abe Ribicoff in his speech nominating George McGovern for president. Picture this, and denouncing what he called the Gestapo tactics being deployed by police on the streets of Chicago.
There is something else in my heart tonight, and not the speech that I prepared to give. The youth of America rallied to the standards of men like George McGovern, like they did to the standards of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And with George McGovern as President of the United States, we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. With George McGovern, we wouldn't have a National Guard.
But, of course, there was plenty of trouble on those streets. In response to the violence surrounding the 68 Democratic Convention, Mayor Richard J. Daley, stumbling a bit as he does it, here defends the police.
The confrontation was not created by the police. The confrontation was created by the people who charged the police. gentlemen, get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
The policeman's there to preserve disorder. Well, it was a wild time. Jack, Ted Van Dyke brings us a kind of insider's view of it. And what a moment in party history.
What a moment. And when Abe Ribicoff was giving that speech, Richard Daley stood up from the Chicago delegation, the Illinois delegation, and said, and a national audience could lip read it as he said it. He said, "Blank you, you Jew, son of a blank, you lousy blank, go home." That was the spirit. You know, the strange thing about the Chicago incident was that, you know, you had 12,000 policemen and at most 10,000 demonstrators. And the policemen tore off their badges, charged the kids yelling, "Kill, kill, kill," beating photographers, newspaper men, anybody you... At one point, Ted, I gather you were grabbed.
I was, yes.
And it was it was really a police riot, and yet the folks at home didn't see it that way. Opinion showed that the public supported the police.
Well, I've got to say that public opinion always is on the side of the forces of order. That's a given.
That's a given, and yet I think Humphrey was right when he said Chicago was a catastrophe. My wife and I went home heartbroken, battered, and beaten.
It was terrible. It was terrible.
We have a lot of people who look back on it, some who remember it. Michelle's calling from Plainfield, Vermont. Michelle, you're on the air with Ted Van Dyke.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Michelle.
I was a student activist. At that time, I wasn't in Chicago, but I was active on my campus and after the campus anti-war activist. And you know, we knew nothing about Humphrey. Nothing. I mean, it's only, I am 62 years old, and it's the past 5 years I learned what a radical he was and what a leading light he was in all these progressive causes. At the time, we saw him as just a pathetic old man. We knew nothing. I mean, maybe if you lived in Minnesota or Wisconsin, you knew, but the rest of us didn't. And I think that was so sad.
It was, yes.
Sure it was extremely sad for him, and it was really sad for us, too. But he didn't. So I guess I could go on with my opinions. He didn't project as a leader. Why didn't we have that information?
Michelle, when you look out on the campaign today, what do you see in the Clinton-Obama race?
I don't think any of the issues are the same, really. I mean, the whole tenor of everything has changed. I don't think you want my opinion on all the ways it's changed, but I do think that Obama certainly projects great depth of feeling and like that he could do something really different, even if it wasn't really different, but I don't know, he just projects something certainly fresh, and like he has an interesting way of thinking about things, and it wouldn't be confrontational, but it would be help, it would actually make things happen, make some changes happen.
Michelle, let's hear from Ted Van Dyke. Ted, it must hurt to hear how Michelle, as a young activist in the 60s, saw your guy, Hubert Humphrey.
Well, he was, of course, the unquestioned progressive leader up until the period in the late 60s when he was trapped by Vietnam, but that's under the bridge. I do think that Obama, to your later point, represents both change and healing simultaneously, and I think that really is the heart of his appeal. There is no anger or toxin in his message. It's a positive, larger vision, and we've not heard that for a while, and I think it's particularly meaningful that a lot of people of my time and generation, for instance, Ted Sorensen, who was a JFK speechwriter, those of us from that period are fully behind Obama because we see the same things we were seeking at the time of our entry point. So you're quite right. It's a different time. But we do really have a chance to make a real change.
But when you look at that character, you know, some may argue whether freshness is enough. That, you know, is it heroic, or to go with your book title, is it foolish? The Clinton camp kind of suggests that there's a foolishness about that posture toward the world, that it's not hard-headed enough, that it's not tough enough to do the necessary.
Well, I disagree with that. I think the Clinton campaign is trying to paint Obama as inexperienced and unready, but the fact is that both Obama and Hillary have approximately equal experience in big national, international issues, similar educational backgrounds. But to put it one way, Obama speaks in poetry, Hillary in prose. Hillary talks about a health care plan, which, frankly, is not much different from Obama's. Obama talks about changing the country, changing where we are, where we are going. That's a greater leadership. So that's what I find particularly appealing. There are plenty of 10-point plans around, and I've helped frame a lot of them, to address just about every problem in front of the country. But larger leadership is very rare.
Let's go to Linda in Beverly, Massachusetts. Linda, you're on the air.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
And what I would like to ask Mr. Van Dyke about is the Kennedy administration. I have always been under the impression that the Black Caucus was very displeased with Kennedy when they went in to visit him, that they felt somewhat used to help elect him, and then did not feel that he was really going to present their case. And it is also, you know, my understanding that Johnson, who had a great deal more power as a senator than he would ever have as a vice president, really showed his loyalty to the Democratic Party by running as a vice president. Now, it was quite accidental that he became president, and, you know, it was just the most one of the most upsetting things to our country. But on the other hand, he helped secure the South for Kennedy, but that the blacks did not feel that he was going to help them accomplish their needs.
Linda, let us pick it up. Ted Van Dyke, what do you say to that, Linda's judgment of history there on JFK?
Well, it's quite true that at the time of President Kennedy's assassination, liberals and pro-civil rights forces were very impatient with him. He was perceived as taking a very cautious approach on civil rights. Even though Robert Kennedy and Nick Katzenbach over at Justice were strongly pro-civil rights, so was Kennedy himself. But he was a very cautious guy. Johnson, on the other hand, you're quite right. It was almost by accident that he was put on the ticket. But he was the one who, after Kennedy's death, saw to passage of the 64 Civil Rights Act. He was the one who, in the Great Society, passed the 1965 Voting Rights Act. He did tangibly more for black Americans than any president before or since. It's quite true. I think President Kennedy, had he lived, would have been more active on that front. Remember, he was only there for 1,000 days. But it was Johnson who got it done.
The hopes were high at the beginning. Here's a clip from the 1961 inaugural address of President John F. Kennedy. Some of the most famous words in American political history here, asking the American people to come together, make the country better for all humankind.
My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.
JFK at his inauguration in 1961. Jack Beatty, there's the highest blown rhetoric you could ask for. And yet, as Ted Van Dyke says, it would emerge that he would have only 1,000 days and LBJ would be the get-it-done guy on the other side of that time.
Yeah, you know, you can't outvie me for admiration for JFK. I was 18 when he was elected president. He was my hero, and what I've learned about the Cuban Missile Crisis makes him grow bigger and bigger. Yet, that call and that inaugural for sacrifice, for putting the country above self and so on, the nobility of all that, that isn't very far from the sort of messianism that took us into Vietnam and that deepened the commitment in Vietnam. And those of us who admire John F. Kennedy have to wonder about this call for nobility and sacrifice and putting the country first and, you know, fighting on the ramparts and so on. A lot of Americans lost their lives, as we now know, for nothing, for worse than nothing, and partly because of rhetoric like that.
Ted Van Dyke, how do you look back on that, then, the heroic rhetoric itself?
Well, I admire the rhetoric, and it still brings tears to my eyes, as it did when I first heard it. But Jack is quite right. There was an underside to that view, recurring Wilsonianism that's always bounced back in our foreign policy, whereby we are going to take into our hands the changing of the world around us. And in fact, Vietnam was a dreadful mistake. It was not corrected by Kennedy before his death. It was not corrected by Johnson, who kept the Kennedy advisors on and was, in fact, somewhat intimidated by them. Certainly not by Nixon. When Humphrey lost the election in 68, we thought Nixon would liquidate the war. Within a month, it was not his war. Yet more Americans died in the Nixon presidency than in the Kennedy and Johnson presidencies combined. I would like to think that over this time we have learned something. The Iraq intervention was another strategic mistake of the same magnitude. But we've got to, there's the one thing I find fault in with Obama's rhetoric, you know, in his standard speech, his peroration is, we're going to change America, we're going to change the world. Mm-hmm. My revision would be, well, let's start with America first and see how we do there. the world is out there and we must deal with it. We've got to try to move things in a generally benign and progressive direction. But we have no mandate to direct others as to how to live.
But in terms of a political message, which has been the more successful for Democrats over the years? The look homeward America or the, you know, sort of universal message of speak to and act in the whole world?
Well, from Wilson onward, we have tended toward this larger view, which is high-minded but can get you in great trouble if you apply it in the wrong places in the wrong way.
Jack, you get the feeling, though, that voters expect that, almost that, you know, full global message. Without it, this seems to be a missing end of the sentence.
You know, we keep waiting for the voters not to like it. I do, at least. I mean, I would have thought that Vietnam burned it out. But George Bush Sr. said that, you know, we'd got over the Vietnam syndrome with the first Gulf War. Well, that syndrome was really a rejection of this idea that we can do whatever we want with the world, that our power, just because it's ours, is benign, and that we're a force for unequivocal good and American might and so on. Maybe after this Iraq experience, Americans will recognize the world is much too complicated for force to be used in any useful way except in defense.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're taking the long view today of the Democratic Party's moment with Ted Van Dyke, 40-year veteran of the political world, political life advisor to, well, a long, long list. Humphrey, McGovern, Carter, Ted Kennedy, Mondale, Hart, Tsongas. Ted Van Dyke joins us from Seattle. His new memoir is Heroes, Hacks, and Fools, Memoirs from the Political Inside. Let's get a call from Hartford, Connecticut, and Michael. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question for Mr. Van Dyke regarding what I fear is the similarity between the optimism of the Jimmy Carter campaign with the slogan, why not the best, and that I support Obama, but I'm worried it's going to be a replay of that same level of disappointment that the Carter's presidency represented for me.
Ted Van Dyke, what do you say?
Michael, I would try to encourage you on that count. I helped Jimmy Carter after he had gained the nomination, but I must tell you that he was a brief one-term governor of Georgia and was almost a blank slate entering the presidency. He was deeply inexperienced and lacked knowledge in both foreign and domestic policy, and the ensuing four-year term proved it. Obama, by contrast, has been in the state senate of Illinois. He's been in the U.S. Senate. He's been involved in big issues. Entering the campaign season, he's far, far better informed and grounded in big issues than Jimmy Carter was at a comparable period. So I don't fear that at all. I think there's no really comparability.
In your long career, you described the Carter years as a kind of turning point for the Democratic Party, and in your view, not a good one. Let's listen to just a little tape from the summer of 1979, the famous malaise speech that Jimmy Carter gave at a time when there were long lines at the pump and energy shortages, a recession. The White House took a lot of the blame for that. President Carter challenged the American people to change things.
We simply must have faith in each other, faith in our ability to govern ourselves, and faith in the future of this nation. Restoring that faith and that confidence to America is now the most important task we face. It is a true challenge of this generation of Americans. One of the visitors to Camp David last week put it this way: we've got to stop crying and start sweating. Stop talking and start walking. Stop cursing and start praying. The strength we need will not come from the White House, but from every house in America.
Jimmy Carter, the malaise speech, 1979. Ted Van Dyke, he came in. People saw him as a breath of fresh air. Some people are describing Obama that way. Obama gets also criticized by the Clinton camp for not being experienced enough. I mean, do you have some fear in the back of your mind, like our caller in Connecticut, that, you know, some years out, if you come in with too little experience, you're not sure how to work the tumblers, and there you are sitting in the White House saying, I can't solve it, you solve it.
No, I think Obama's experience is at least comparable to John F. Kennedy's when he took office in 1961. The charge by the Clintons that he's inexperienced doesn't hold up. Hillary in the White House, for instance, had no security clearance, totally uninvolved in any national security foreign policy issue. Her principal substantive assignment was health care reform, which she mishandled badly. Both Obama and Hillary have been effective, hardworking senators, but I don't see either one as having any experience or competence edge over the other. I think either one, if in the White House, would be competent.
You describe a change in motivation in the presidency of Jimmy Carter that you see as carrying on through the Clinton years and that you weren't happy about. Describe that for us.
Well, I think we talked earlier about the motivations of the post-war and 60s generations to pass a very progressive agenda, to create racial progress, social justice in the country. And all our presidential candidates in a long stream right up until 1976 came out of that school. In 1976, Jimmy Carter was the only moderate candidate in an otherwise liberal field and squeaked through to get the nomination. But he was a total pragmatist. He did not come from that background. He simply wanted to be president, and he was very pragmatic, had few views on foreign policy. He'd been a hawkish Scoop Jackson Democrat. Domestic policy, he was an undefined populist. So his campaign really was about this undefined Mr. Smith goes to Washington reformer. It had no real substantive basis. And part of it came from his southern border state base, where the traditional Democratic agenda was not uppermost. Bill Clinton, in 1992, was elected in the same kind of general framework. He had gone to Ivy League schools. He was a part of the liberal peace movement. But he could teach at Rounder Flat. He could espouse a position on any pragmatic basis. He was apart from that school that had gone straight through from the early 60s. Ted Kennedy, probably the best present exemplar. So we diverged from who we were. And I think it's really, we now are on the path of getting back to who we were. I think Obama represents that. I think Hillary, too, more than her husband, would return to that path. But I think we, for a long, long time, went with pragmatism over principle, and it's high time we returned.
Jack Beatty, that may be, well, there's Ted Van Dyke's interpretation, and he may be right. At the same time, Democrats seem sincerely and in very large numbers completely torn right now between these two candidates. So maybe there are just different views of what the party ought to be, where it ought to go.
Yes, but I think that maybe Ted would agree with me that these are both progressive candidates. They both use that word even. And, you know, you can't talk about a program of national health insurance, which in effect this would be, not quite that, but nearly, without really being a progressive Democrat. That's using government in a very powerful way to affect the lives of millions and millions of Americans. Big, big deal. So I think that is a change. I mean, I can't imagine Jimmy Carter with his minimalism taking that view at all. You know, there's a great story about Carter told by Tip O'Neill. It may be apocryphal, but Tip said that, you know, Carter would always carry his luggage on the planes and carry, you know, as if it were heavy. And at one point, Tip said, "Let me carry that for you, Mr. President." He said, "Oh, no, that's okay. Oh, let me carry it, Mr. President." He takes it away from him. He said, "The suitcase was empty."
that's
just like Jimmy.
Carrying his own bags, but nothing in them.
In fact, that was true. There was a famous photo, which all of us were familiar with, of Carter carrying a clothing bag over his back wherever he went. And in fact, the clothing bag was empty. It was just a prop.
But what about the notion that this time Democrats are looking at two progressives, maybe two idealists, so it's not a choice of that?
No, I agree with that, and I distinguish Hillary from her husband. Hillary is more in that stream that I talked about. She is more programmatic, 10-point programish, than Obama is. But either one of them, as I said earlier, would represent a return of one kind or another to our prior posture.
Let's get a call from Beverly Hills, California. And Charles, hi, Charles, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
One of your previous callers said that when she was active in 68 with Hubert Humphrey, she really knew very, very little about Hubert Humphrey. And George F. Kennan, who was a very prominent diplomat under the Eisenhower administration, when Eisenhower said, "Beware of the military-industrial complex," Kennan said, "Beware of the growing power of the press." And here we are today, and it's the press. It's General Electric, who owns NBC, and it's Sumner Redstone, who owns Viacom, that really manipulates the populace and the electorate. And I don't think people really are in touch with the candidates. We see what the press allows us to see, and what they allow us to see is what serves their best interest, building airplanes and missiles and military war equipment.
Charles, let us get the long view here from Ted Van Dyke, a little George Kennan, a little Ike, and a lot of concern there over the role of the press. Ted, do you see it as having evolved or devolved in the kind of damaging way that Charles does?
I don't see any straight line between the military-industrial complex to the media to the news coverage. I do see, however, some other changes that are disquieting. That's what I call the narrow casting, which has taken place in the media. It used to be that we had a common information base in the country, which came from the three network news networks, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and the three news weekly magazines. Everything is far more narrow. Those broad horizontal publications and news sources are less important. People are on their cell phones or on their computers, turning to bloggers, seeking very narrow sources of information. And polling data tells us that as a result, that and many other things, the electorate is really dumbed down. People are very badly informed. I cite in the book, for instance, data at the end of last year which showed that a majority of the American people, about 50%, at this late date still believe that 9/11 was undertaken with the connivance of the U.S. government. Another 50% of the American people found still believed weapons of mass destruction were present in Iraq. After nonstop weeks of media coverage, nearly half the American people had no idea of the physical locations either of New Orleans or Louisiana.
But do you see that as a result of the malice of media masters, media owners?
Not malice, just carelessness. A dumbing down of the media, too. If you look at the minutes, for instance, devoted to hard news coverage in local metropolitan news channels, in many places you'll be lucky to find 5 minutes of hard news in a week. It's all lifestyle, weather, crime, sports, because that's where it's thought the audience is driving.
And that carries its own price tag in a democracy. Yeah. Ted, you've got some stories in here that I certainly didn't hear at the time. Maybe nobody did. I wish you'd tell us, for one, about the Rockefeller role in the Hubert Humphrey-Richard Nixon standoff back in 68.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting story. Humphrey and Nelson Rockefeller had always been friends, much alike in many ways, optimists, believers in government action.
Though Rockefeller, obviously, a big Republican.
Of course. And after Rockefeller had been defeated by Richard Nixon in the 1968 nominating race, we were surprised while in New York in October of that year to see Nelson and Happy Rockefeller at a reception held after the Al Smith dinner there, in which Tom Dewey also was present. It was the Democratic reception. Down the hall was being held Richard Nixon's reception. Both candidates had been at the dinner. Happy Rockefeller approached me at the reception and said, was I Humphrey's assistant? I told her I was. She said, how's the campaign going? I said, it's doing better. She said, how are you fixed for money? I said, we need it. Whereupon she said, well, Nelson and I will help you. We think Nixon is a real
okay.
And whereupon she then moved over and spoke to Humphrey. He nodded his head. Confirming what I had told Happy. And later, as the Rockefellers left the party, she waved at me and pointed to her purse. Well, almost immediately thereafter, in the last 2 weeks of the campaign, we began spending money on media, which probably equaled Richard Nixon's. And I called our campaign treasurer and said, where is this money coming from? And he said, you know where it's coming from.
Compliments of the Rockefellers, Happy Rockefeller with a salty tongue and also a big purse. Give us the kind of sad, the certainly sad story about the neurologist that Hubert Humphrey wanted to send out to Robert Kennedy after he was shot.
Oh, that was a terrible
there?
Thing.
Mm-hmm.
We were in at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs on the evening of Robert Kennedy's shooting in Los Angeles. And almost immediately, we received a phone call from Steve Smith and Pierre Salinger, who were with Robert Kennedy in Los Angeles, asking if Humphrey could arrange a flight immediately to get a Boston neurosurgeon to Los Angeles to help Robert Kennedy, who was still alive. Humphrey called the brass at the Air Force Academy. They said they'd get a plane out right away. And about 5 minutes later, we got a call from them saying that the White House had canceled the plane. It would not be sent. It was a dreadful thing to have had.
LBJ's order.
Yeah. As it turned out, the Kennedys got their own transportation for the neurosurgeon. And when he arrived, he told them it was hopeless. Nothing could have been done in any case. But that was a truly sad episode.
So a lot of history, a lot of years, and now the Democratic Party looking at these two candidates, you say both you find Clinton and Obama progressive, kind of in the vein that you would applaud, but yet you come down on the Obama side of that. And why is it? Tell us once more.
Because his appeal is broader, more hopeful. It's uniting. He's not using, as Hillary does from time to time, wedge issues. For instance, you'll see in Hillary's appeal at the end of her debates or in speeches, she always comes back to appealing to the over 60 women who were part of the women's movement and making the point that her candidacy deserves support because of the glass ceiling and what has happened to women. Obama doesn't speak as a black man. He speaks as an American. We can see by looking at them who these people are. We can see that Hillary's a white woman. We can see that Obama is a black man. I should think we should be able to go beyond that. That was, after all, what the 64 Civil Rights Act was all about, to take us past such considerations. So I think his is a larger, more hopeful message, although either one, in my judgment, would be a far better president than John McCain.
Mm. Ted Van Dyke, the new memoir is Heroes, Hacks, and Fools. Jack, does he put you up on a sort of on a hill of perspective there on Democratic Party history?
He does, and he gives us John Adams talking about people who participate in foreign public affairs, the spirit of public happiness. That's what they feel. And I expect you felt it all your career, Ted.
Yes, I've had a fortunate life to have been a part of it.
Let us all be happy warriors in that spirit. Ted Van Dyke, Heroes, Hacks, and Fools is the memoir. Mr. Van Dyke, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you, Jack.
Jack, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.